Today's Teisho is case 57 in the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 57 is entitled Joshu's I Alone Am Holy Throughout Heaven and Earth. Ango's introduction. When you have not yet penetrated it, it is like silver mountains and iron cliffs. When you have penetrated it, you find that you yourself are the silver mountains and iron cliffs. If you ask how to do it, I would say that if you attain realization in the exercise of qi, you will occupy the pinnacle of attainment and will allow not even the holy ones to spy on you. If you cannot do this, see and study the ancients' doings as follows. Main subject. A monk said to Joshu, "It is said, the great way is not difficult. It only abhors choice and attachment." Now, what are non-choice and non-attachment? Joshu said, "I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth." The monk said, "That's still choice and attachment." Joshu said, "You country bumpkin, show me where are choice and attachment." The monk was speechless. Secho's verse, deep as the sea, high as the mountain, the fly's attempt to face the gale, the ant trying to attack the pillar, choice and attachment, non-choice and attachment, a cloth-covered drum that reaches the eaves. So thank you all very much for coming to practice Zen this morning. This is a wonderful opportunity to sit together in the heart mind. It's really precious, and I thank you so much for making the time to do this. You know, today is, or this weekend is Memorial Day weekend. And when I was walking to the bathroom, I noticed that it was pouring rain. So, you know, I'm sure many people were, many people have good memories of Memorial Days where they go down the shore or they have friends over for a barbecue and, childhood memories like that. And then as adults, they've continued the ritual. And so, you know, the feeling that people were hoping that this would be a beautiful sunny weekend and everybody could go down to Sandy Hook and basically relive that way of life, you know. I myself am not really a beach person, but I've certainly been to Sandy Hook and ridden a bicycle, and I've been on the various boardwalks, and it's wonderful. You know, summer, you can get a lemonade or you can get a smoothie, you know, and walk down the boardwalk. You can rent a bike or you can even rent a, down at Sandy Hook, you can even rent a kayak, right? And there's so many things you can do and you have wonderful memories, you know. It's all part of the ritual of living in New Jersey. And, you know, we've all been cooped up for months now. It's hard to believe. After a while, the time just goes so quickly. And I have the feeling that people were looking forward to maybe trying to get back to normal, as we say. And I myself, you know, have moments like that. I would love to go to Souk Sagar and have a meal after this sit today. I'd love to. There's a Thai restaurant in Westfield that I love, and I would love to go over there. And I'd like to go into the city. I'd like to catch a train and go in and maybe go over to the Whitney Museum or go to Central Park and walk around. You know, it's so magical in the summer. And, you know, that's not yet going to happen. And I do think people might, you know, tugs at your heartstrings to think that, you know, this is something that has been so much a part of your life. And And naturally, we want it to come back. We want it to be normal again. But you know, I have the feeling that if we hold on too much to that desire, we aren't going to be able to realize the possibilities of this special time. You know, normal life is like a ritual that everybody participates in. And basically everybody gets up at 7 a.m. or 6 a.m. and everybody's on the Garden State Parkway at about the same time. If you have to drive on it in the morning, you know that because there's like 40,000 cars. And we all are living this reality. And we think it's real because everybody else is doing it. You know, I talked a little bit about this last time. This is habit energy, right? What the sutras call habit energy. You know, habit energy makes things real. So if everybody, you know, you learn in high school, I remember when I was in high school, actually early in high school, I think it was the 9th grade, I got my first alarm clock. And it was a big metal alarm clock that I had picked out at a store. And it was really ugly. And it actually had bells on it, old style alarm clock. And when it would ring, there was a little striker that would hit the bells on top of the clock. It was like a cartoon alarm clock. And I remember my mother trying to talk me out of buying it because it was kind of ugly and ridiculous. But I had that, and I would set it, and it was a mechanical clock. You had to wind it, you know. And that was my first alarm clock, and I had learned the symbolism, you could say, of the alarm clock, right? I actually got an alarm clock that looked like a cartoon of an alarm clock. And I was learning, you know, the ritual is you set, and it, when I was a little kid, my mother would wake me up. She would come in and say, time for school. But as you become an adult, you realize it's my responsibility to get myself up. So you get an alarm clock and you set the alarm clock. And if you say to somebody, uh-oh, my alarm clock went off late. Or my alarm clock didn't go off. I'm late because my alarm clock didn't. Everybody knows what you're talking about because they all have an alarm clock. And so, you know, basically, you know, we all have an alarm clock. We all get up. You either take a shower at night or you take a shower in the morning or you take a shower at night and in the morning. You know, and then you jump in your car and you drive to work. That's a sort of standard day. And there's no reason it has to be like that except that everybody does it. It's like a custom. It's like a custom. And there's, you know, we could go to work at 11 o'clock or 3 o'clock. And there are people, like in my job, I'm a teacher, so I actually have a lot of flexibility. If I'm not teaching on a particular day, I can decide when I want to go in and I can decide when I want to leave. But I know that, you know, my father worked for the Defense Department, for the Department of the Navy, and, you know, he would be on the highway into D.C. every day at the same time, sitting bumper to bumper. It was expected of him to sit there bumper to bumper and get to work by a certain time. So, you know, all of this is like ritual. And the more we do it, the more real it feels. And if you do something really new, if you do something really new, you might even feel that it's unreal. You might say, this is so unreal, you know. But habit energy, repetition, makes it real. And our lives are made out of these, are made up of these habit energy rituals, you know, and that we usually share with other people. And then give everything this kind of realism, this kind of feeling of reality. So, you know, I remember, you know, for about 10 years, I would teach every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. It was like my first 10 years at Rutgers, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I'd have a class on Monday and Wednesday, and I would have a class on Wednesday and Friday. And then, you know, I changed my schedule. I started to teach a Monday, Tuesday, Thursday class. And I remember it was a Friday, and I went to, to the grocery store. And it was the weirdest thing. I felt this guilt. Like I should be, you know, I should be at my job right now, not at the grocery store. That's a habit energy, right? You know, I'm out of the ritual. You know, how can this be? Something's wrong. And habit energies are invested with a lot of emotion, right? I mean, so, you know, I can still remember my first alarm clock. You know, I can still remember, you know, my first job. You know, I think I still had the same alarm clock. I learned how to get up and get to work on time and so on. And, you know, when I think back on those events, you know, they have a lot of emotional power because they were so much a part of my life. And you know, going down the shore on Memorial Day is like an energy habit, right? It's something people do. And the more you do it, the more real it becomes. And this is a really interesting aspect of people because, you know, we tend to think of ourselves as free agents. You know, we're free. You know, the political system says we're free. The Declaration of Independence says freedom is very much part of our life, you know, this sort of thing. But actually, humans are not very free. And they're not very free because the way they structure their lives is with these rituals. And in fact, we have a ritual here. I mean, we get up, please come to sit at 7 o'clock, recite the sutras, and so on. You know, humans need rituals, actually. You know, if you don't have a structure to your life, it can be very, very difficult to deal with. I was just reading an article, and they said, during this period, it's important, you know, not to let everything go. Not to just wake up when you want to wake up, go to bed when you want to go to bed. They said, you know, try to create a structure for your day that you repeat, you know, 5 days a week, just as you would on your job. So, you know, if it's Tuesday, make a note, you know, you're going to get up on Tuesday and mow the lawn or something like that. Or, you know, create a kind of schedule, a kind of habit energy ritual for yourselves on each day. And I actually think that's very wise. I think, you know, there have been periods in my life when I haven't had much structure. And I definitely think those were difficult periods. So I'm not knocking having rituals. And I'm not knocking habit energy, which is how we make things real, right? And doing Zazen is also creating a habit, right? It's a good habit. But I'm saying that, you know, we're not as free as we think we are. You know, we create these habits, and especially if other people accept them as real, they become real to us. And you know, it's difficult to get out of that. It's difficult to escape from that. And the more of these rituals we inhabit, we create and inhabit, you know, actually, even though we need them, it's very limiting in a lot of ways. You know, by the time you're 45 years old, let's say, you know, you can be very, 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 very set in your ways, right? I mean, if you're not careful, you know, you can, by the time you're 45, you can basically have created the life patterns that you're going to live out until you die, right? And actually, when that happens, it's very difficult for people to open up and do something new. Even if you try it, it's going to be difficult and challenging, right? I mean, children have a little less of this. So, you know, they're a little less creatures of ritual and habit. And, you know, when things go wrong, they can sort of welcome it, you know. I can remember this experience. I was in kindergarten in Baltimore, and actually the building still exists. I used Google Maps and Google Street View to look at it the other day. I hadn't looked at it in, 50 years, my old elementary school in Baltimore. And I remember there was a wing that was the kindergarten wing. It was off to one side of the school. And they kept the kindergarten children sort of separate from the other children. And I remember we were all coming out of kindergarten, and I think we all had our lunch boxes and our projects. We had, made Thanksgiving turkeys or something. You trace your hand in colored paper, and you cut out your hand and you glue it on a different colored piece of paper or something. With that glue, you could eat, right? I don't know if you remember that mint flavored glue. But we were leaving the school, and somebody had raked this giant pile of leaves. And as soon as we looked at those leaves, it was just like an invitation to dive into the leaves, right? And all these kids were jumping into the leaves and screaming and having a wonderful time. So, if they were a little older, the routines would have been so powerful, they might not have been able to take advantage of that. So, by the time you're an adult, you're certainly not going to jump in a pile of leaves next to your building with glee, and that's a pity in a certain way. So it's hard for us to stay open, right? It's hard for us to stay open. We become the prisoner of these rituals. And, I even though it's difficult to be sort of sequestered, and even though it's difficult to be in this place we're in right now, it's possible that this could be a good thing. And it's certainly terrible that 100,000 people have died. And it's especially because it's probably completely unnecessary that about 60,000 of those people died. That's very sad, and it's not over. Lots of people are still going to get sick. But on the other hand, some really good things are going to come out of this, or could come out of this, if we can be open to the possibilities ourselves, And I think something like Zazen is very much about that. I think it's learning how to step outside our habits and look around with sort of fresh eyes. That's very much what Mushin is all about. It's true. We have a habit. We sit down on the cushion. There are three sits of 25 minutes and so on. But when you enter deep Mushin, you're really it gives you the chance to step outside of your loops, your familiar mental loops. Most of our thoughts, even our thoughts, are somewhat habitual. They're somewhat habits, right? And this is the problem. If you have a habit, it's very difficult to get out of it. And habits feel so reassuring. So something like Mushin is a way, sort of like pushes you out or stops the energy habit formation, that pattern formation. And you're suddenly left groping, which is not necessarily a comfortable feeling. But it's really our only chance to live in a bigger world is to go through that uncertainty and to be sort of outside the circle, looking around. And of course, when you're outside the circle, some of what you want is to get back in the circle right away. But, gradually, if you stay there long enough, you begin to like breathe the free air and you notice things you wouldn't have noticed. So, everybody's had this experience. I mean, I think people stay with Zazen because they've all had this experience of coming out of the meditation hall in an evening or on a Saturday and listening to the rain. And the rain just is you become one with the rain. And actually, that's the result of having stepped outside of our habitual mental habits, our energy habits. And usually it's emptiness that allows us to do that. And then you hear the rain and it's just like, you become the rain. Now, you know, the nature of humans is such that you form a mental image of that event and then you try to turn it into a habit. So if you leave the zendo and it's raining and you just are about to get in your car and you hear the rain and you just become one with the rain, that experience is so beautiful and so exciting that it's probably the case that the next time it's raining outside, you're going to want to have that experience. But actually, you've already begun to turn it into a habit, and it won't have the same character. It won't have that same quality, that freshness, that you won't be able to connect in the same way. So, you know, the pattern of Zen is to constantly use emptiness to liberate us from our mental habits, from our habit energies. And that's why on a Zen altar, there's usually a statue of Manjushri with his sword in hand. You might think, what is a sword? You know, Buddhism is a peaceful religion. Why does this guy have a sword in his hand? But Manjushri is the bodhisattva of transcendental wisdom, the wisdom of the other shore, and he carries in his hand a sword to cut away. And what he's cutting away, basically, are these energy habits, these habitual formations that prevent us from experiencing the world in a fresh way. And you know, we can try other things. I'm not saying there aren't other things. You could get in a plane and go to a place you've never been before, right? And that could be good. That could be liberating. But sometimes, you know, you find that when you do something like that, it's difficult still to encounter the reality of things because you're still drawing on habits, you know? It's like the first time I went hiking in the Rockies was a totally mind-blowing experience. And I had such a good memory that the following summer I wanted to go back and repeat it. And every time I was grasping for the same experience, it eluded me, you know? I can remember on one hike, my friend Larry and I went on this, we hiked maybe 12, 15 miles in one day. It was a brutal day of hiking. And we came in, the trail was very close to this little town, and we were sitting in our tents and we thought, you know, it would be wonderful just to go down and have a meal and have a beer. And, you know, we had been hiking for days and we had this really difficult hike and we actually walked down into town without our backpacks. So we had, you know, I don't know what this, I wasn't a vegetarian at this time, but I think I had a chili dog or something and a beer, a can of beer. And it was just paradise. It was like, this is so good. You know, next time I tried to have that experience, you know, it wasn't the same. The hot dog didn't taste as good. You know, the beer wasn't as good. You know, it's difficult. The mind creates habits right away. And then habits are the occasion for craving, right? Because, you know, as we're going through our lives relying on habit, gradually it's like the life can get drained out of things. You know, it's like, every day you go to your job, you know, you think, oh, here I am in the car again. Here I am in the office. And, you know, when you go back to your office after 6 months, it's going to be, I'm so glad to be back in the office. And that'll fade, though, because that's the way the human mind works. We begin to create these habitual patterns. And as we do that, the life drains away. And so this is our big problem, really, is how to keep alive and how to get out of our habits. And, you know, I was reading something that was pretty interesting. It was a study of people who have certain kinds of multiple personality. There are a set of multiple personality disorders. And those people who have those have been studied by brain scientists lately. And, you know, people used to believe, specialists used to believe, that people with multiple personality disorders were not telling the truth. And this actually was how when I was younger, I always thought these people were faking it, right? You know, now I'm Susan. Now I'm Guinevere, right? And it seemed impossible that these people could really be different people. They were maybe pretending to be different people. But they've done very extensive research on people with dissociative disorders. And they find that when they're in different personalities, their brains actually function differently, you know? And they have done a lot of studies with these people, and they find that when a person is Susan, you know, she has this set of emotions, she processes information this way, and when the person becomes Guinevere, often she doesn't even know what happened to Susan, and she processes information in a different way. And they, as I say, they've done these brain scans of these people, and it kind of blew their minds that when people have dissociative disorders, when they move from one personality to another, they don't connect, they don't remember the other personality, and their brains work differently. And I think that's fascinating, right? You know, the self is really, you could say, like an ensemble of mental habits, right? And somehow these people have gone through some kind of trauma that's allowed them to step outside of one set of mental habits and form another set of mental habits. And, you know, and as I say, the scientists were pretty astonished that it wasn't like the brain working the same way in each case. The brain was working very differently. Different emotions, different processing habits were functioning. And the article raised an interesting issue. It says, what is the self then? You know, what does it mean to have a self or to be a self? And, you know, these are people who have multiple selves, and, you know, they can transition from one self to another. And when they do, you know, their mental worlds are totally real to them. So they're not faking it. You know, when you're Susan, this is how you think, this is how you feel, this is what you fear, this is what you crave. And when you're Guinevere, this is how you think, this is how you feel. It's totally different. And the person who wrote the article said, you know, this really raises interesting questions about what it means to have a self. You know, and as a Buddhist, I think I get it. You know, I would agree. I think a lot of the self we occupy is, as the sutras say, just a product of habit. And you know, it's difficult to get out, you know, without some kind of terrible trauma, unless we practice zazen, and then we do get out. But, you know, the gravitational pull of that self we constructed is very difficult to escape from for normal people. But then the article went on, and it said something that I thought was fascinating. You know, it said, is it possible, and this was like wild speculation, but, you know, it said, is it possible that we are all suffering from a kind of multiple personality disorder, and that we have sort of like created this sort of, how shall I put it? We've all created these selves that have isolated us from other parts of our intelligence. See? So we have a big intelligence, basically, this person was speculating, that we have a big intelligence, but we create a personality that thinks it's Kurt, or thinks it's Susan, or thinks it's Guinevere. And, you know, that's only a small portion of our whole intelligence, or our whole awareness. And, of course, when I read that, I thought, well, that sounds a lot like Buddhism, doesn't it? You know, the idea is that there's a kind of, like, bigger mind, and we have sort of, like, dissociated from that bigger mind. It's like we're all suffering from a dissociative disorder. And the dissociative disorder makes us think we're Kurt, or we're Susan, or we're Bill, right? But actually, that's just a compartment, right? And I wonder if in some ways you could think about what we're doing with meditation as sort of like overcoming a kind of trauma, right? Or a kind of dissociation. Those moments when we enter deep machine, you know, we're like getting out of our patterns. And we can experience things in fresh ways, right? I won't name any names, but you know, there's a person in our group who's working on a koan, and he was a cigarette smoker. And after working with a certain koan, he said, you know, the darndest thing has happened to me. I've stopped smoking cigarettes. And he said, it's been like a month and I just don't want a cigarette. And I think that's a good example of sort of where I'm going with this, right? I mean, craving a cigarette becomes part of who you are, right? It's part of your identity. I mean, I'm from a generation where the coolest people in the world smoke cigarettes. So I remember when I was 18 years old going to see, many of you who are younger don't even know who Humphrey Bogart is. But Humphrey Bogart was the coolest person on the planet at one time. And in all of his movies, he's smoking a cigarette. And actually, believe it or not, even some of the Beatles smoked cigarettes. In fact, George Harrison smoked cigarettes. And I remember seeing pictures of him smoking a cigarette. He actually died of lung cancer, as a matter of fact. So, you know, cigarettes were so cool. I myself wanted to smoke so that I could be cool. But when I would smoke, it was such a horrible experience. I just couldn't stand it. I felt like throwing up, luckily for me. But a lot of people learn to tolerate that because it's part of being sociable. It's a ritual, right? You know, you go out, you know, it used to be the case when I first started in my job, everybody in my office smoked. And it was like a ritual. Everybody would, you know, reach for a cigarette, light it up, you know, and it's, you get that nicotine. It's very satisfying. And then you crave another one. So it became real for everybody in my office. And it's a habit that creates a habit energy, right? That's hard to break. And this is certainly true for the person in our group who was working with the koan. He said, you know, the funniest thing is, I don't even want to see, I haven't wanted a cigarette for 3 weeks. See, I think that's getting out, I think that's undoing our dissociation from the big mind. Undoing our dissociation from the big mind. And you could think of everything we do in Zen as undoing our dissociation from the big mind. You know, the tragedy is that most people rarely get out of their dissociated state. You know, rarely. Every once in a while, somebody, you'll do something that just, you know, just takes you, blows you out of yourself. You know, when I was younger, it was hiking, backpacking in the mountains. You turn a corner and there's this 14,000 foot peak, you know, just takes your breath away and you don't have a thought in your head of anything except that mountain. And that's so liberating. Other people have that experience in other ways, but you know, unless it happens by accident, it's very difficult for us to be a different person. In fact, you know, it's very difficult to stop being a person. But you know, Buddhism says that actually we're not people. We're not. We think we're a person, but we're not a person. You know, a person is a dissociated state separate from this big mind. See, separate from big mind. And so Zazen is really about undoing our dissociated state and realizing who we are, who we really are. And you know, this is what Daiken Sho is really all about. You know, until we wake up, you know, I identify with Kurt. You know, I'm Kurt, of course. And that's actually a dissociated state. But if you practice Zazen long enough, you know, eventually you stop so much identifying with Kurt or with Susan or whatever you call yourself. And you begin to have this identification with other things and other people. So for example, one of my Dharma friends said she got on a bus or she was walking down the street after a day of meditation or after a session, and she looked at this woman's face and felt she was looking at her own face. Well, that's an undissociated state, right? A non-dissociated state. She was looking at her own face, right? And experiencing it as her own face. So, you know, it's possible to do this, and it's so important right now that I'm so glad that we're here practicing the Great Way together, because, you know, whole societies can go through this process too, right? I mean, a whole society can change, can realize that it's been dissociated and change itself completely. And you know, the more individual people who are not afraid of trying something new, you know, the more likely I think it is that the whole society might change for the better. You know, it just takes a little bit of medicine to cure the whole patient, right? You know, and if people in our sangha and other sanghas are able to be less dissociated, you know, it has an impact on people. People in my office have said, you know, how do you stay so calm? You know, you seem so calm all the time, and they don't know I do a lot of sitting. But I definitely think it leaves a mark. You know, people realize I don't have to be upset about this. I don't have to be angry about this. I can be calm, you know. So what's happening to us as a society is terrible. And to us as individuals, terrible. But, you know, this is something wonderful could come out of this if we can connect ourselves to that big mind as individuals, and who knows, maybe even as a society. And whatever you do, you're helping to connect the society to the big mind. You know, this koan sounds so weird, right? You know, a monk said to Joshu, it is said the great way is not difficult. It only abhors choice and attachment. That's a little different translation of the Shinshin Ming. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. This is translating it a little differently. He says, now, what does it mean to have no preferences? Joshu said, I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. See, now, that sounds like such an ego. We would say that's an ego trip, right? I mean, you're the only enlightened one. And actually, in Buddhist legend, the Buddha himself is supposed to have said that, right? I don't know if he really did, but it sounds like an ego trip until you realize what he's really saying is, you know, I experience everything as my big mind. I experience everything as not separate from myself. It's that experience you get after a day of sitting and you go outside and you suddenly become one with the rain. See, that's an ecstatic experience that is altered consciousness, we would say. But actually, the Buddhist view is no, that's an experience of reality. Our consciousness is defective. Our consciousness is not correct. So we're the dissociated ones. Somebody like Joshu is experiencing the world as it really is, you know, as it really is. And we all get these glimpses once in a while if we practice. So, you know, Joshu isn't an egomaniac, you know, at all. He's talking about the world as it can be if we continue to practice the great way. As if we continue to cultivate Mushin mind and reinvent our lives again and again. You know, if we can get out of our habits, we can get out of our ruts, and we can reinvent our lives. And, you know, you could quit your job, you could sell your house, you could move to Samoa, and nothing would change. You know, people try those kinds of things. They try to reinvent themselves or reinvent their lives, but, you know, they often wind up just living the same life in a different place. Reinventing your life doesn't mean quitting your job, or it might, but it doesn't necessarily mean quitting your job or joining the circus or something like that, because you will likely just repeat, right? It's like my wife's uncle, Paul, is a really great artist, really wonderful artist, and he had four wives, and if you look at their pictures, it's hard to tell them apart. They all look the same, right? He liked women who had dark hair, rather Mediterranean looking, and each of his wives looks almost identical. And every marriage fell apart for the same reasons. You know, he just kept repeating and repeating. He couldn't get out of his loops. He couldn't get out of his energy habits. But it's possible to get out. And the more we get out, the bigger our world becomes. And that's the purpose of Zazen. That's what we're doing. You know, and I would say an hour of sitting is, you know, a lot better, a lot more liberating sometimes than going to Samoa, although Samoa, I'm sure, is a very interesting place. Our true self is the self that can say, I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. In other words, nothing is separate from myself. The monk said, you still have preferences. And Joshu says, oh, come on. You don't know what I'm talking about yet. You know, the monk was speechless. Engo's introduction, when you have not yet penetrated it, it is like a silver mountain and iron cliffs. When you have penetrated it, you find that you yourself are the silver mountains and iron cliffs. You're no longer dissociated. If you ask how to do it, I would say that if you attain realization in the exercise of qi, of liberating meditation energy, you will occupy the pinnacle of attainment and will not allow even the holy ones to spy on you. You're one with them. They can't spy on you because you're one with them. If you cannot do this, see the following, and then you get the koan. Sutro's verse, deep as the sea, high as the mountain, the flies attempt to face the gale, the ant trying to attack the pillar. That's what it's like when we're trapped in our habits, right? It's like you're like an ant trying to move a mountain, or trying to attack a pillar, or a fly trying to face a gale. But when we encounter obstacles, you know, if we become one with what is happening through Mushin, all obstacles disappear. All obstacles disappear. And that includes the obstacle of feeling alone and isolated, right? That, too, is not reality. You know, you could be living by yourself right now in a small apartment, or you could be living in a house full of people, and you could feel just as isolated in that case. You know, what makes us isolated isn't how many people we're living with, but our mental habits, whether we can step out of our mental habits and reconnect with the world. And actually, until Daikensho, and even after, it's a constant cutting away, constantly going back to emptiness. So thank you. This was a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to practice together. I'm so glad you could be here. On Wednesday morning, we start our session, for those of you who are able to attend. If you haven't signed up yet, you can come for 5 days or you can come for 3 days. And even if you can't make all of the sesshin, I hope you'll participate in part of it. I understand that you're living with other people. You're sharing an apartment or a house. So, you know, we're going to start at 7. We'll break at 8:30 for breakfast, and you can go get some breakfast, and you can talk to people. It's okay to talk to them. These are your housemates or your apartment mates or your family. And then, you know, we want to be back on the cushion at 10 or whenever the next sitting schedule is. And, you know, so you're going to have, it's not going to be like sesshin, you know, exactly, but we'll get a lot of time on the cushion and we'll have dokusan. And, you know, you can achieve a huge amount this way. You know, we're changing the ritual, but we're still going to do a lot of sitting. And this could be the best sesshin you ever had. So if you're able to make it, I look forward to seeing you there. And if you're not, please join us as often as you can. Okay? Please come in. Come in to sit as often as you can. So, of course, we'll have our sit tomorrow morning, our Sunday meditation, and Monday evening. And in the meantime, please be safe. Please enjoy your beautiful life. Please keep breaking out of your energy habits and becoming one with everything.